Well, I think, I don't want you to all fall asleep. I think this is good if I have one movie that's quite faint, but I'll let you know then.
Okay.
So this is all about faint galaxies, but I think the slides are bright enough. So it's the third day of the workshop now, but I think it's still, you know, it's my first talk or my only talk, so I should still thank the organizers for inviting me. I think I'll mostly not be talking about blazars. So if you're only here for blazars, well, don't leave, but it'll be mostly about local group galaxies without blazars, and then I'll come to blazars at the end. So this project sort of got started really at the very end of last week, when last year, almost last week, when Christoph and I were both at the Virgo meeting in Leiden, and I gave a similar talk to this about the Loken group without blazars, and Christoph asked me, well, we have this blazar model, why don't you try to see what results you get if you include blazar feedback in the Loken group simulation. So I went ahead and did this, but this is very preliminary, so first talk about the Loken group without blazars, why I think we may not actually need blazars in the Loken group, and then talk about the blazar results. So this is now the new and improved Loken group in a blazar-heated universe. And I should point out that I'm now actually at the University of Helsinki, even though it still says Durham here. I'm mostly collaborating with people from Durham, where I was before, and people from the University of Victoria in Canada as well. So I'll give a brief introduction to Loken groups and small scales in general, why they're interesting, I think. Then I'll talk about reionization and dwarf galaxies in the Apostle simulations, and then I'll talk about the blazar heating. So we know that the Lambda CDM model is largely successful, meaning it's very successful to describe structure formation on large scales. So the structures we see in the cosmic microwave background have been pretty well predicted or matched by the Lambda CDM model. And also the distribution of galaxies on large scales is very well matched by pure dark matter Lambda CDM simulation. So in blue, this is from different galaxy surveys, including Sloan, for example, or CFA. And in red, I'm sure you've all seen this before, this is from the Millennium simulation, which is a pure gravity dark matter simulation CDM, and the structures are virtually identical. Now, this is from Volker Springle simulation 2005. Now we can do this all with baryon feedbacks, with hydrodynamics, with no magnetic fields. So this is a very simple model, but these are still quite complex simulations. So this sort of shows to scale the volume of the Eagle simulation that now has a full, well, model for additional processes such as gas dynamics, gas cooling, star formation, feedback and stellar winds, the formation of supermassive black holes, accretion onto supermassive black holes, and feedback from that, and also includes reionization. So on large scales, I would say the Eagle model does remarkably well. So for example, this is the stellar mass function over five orders of magnitude. These gray symbols are from Baldry et al. They're similar to the ones that Ho-John Mo showed in his talk. And the blue line is the Eagle simulation. So it matches the stellar mass function now over many orders of magnitude. You remember that the halo mass function is this sort of almost a single power law. And so this depression from the single power law at the high mass end and at the low mass end can now be explained due to various feedback processes that we include in these simulations. And it also matches other, so the, I have to say, this is not a pure prediction. The feedback processes that we can't really resolve are calibrated in order to match this. But for example, it also reproduces very well things like the baryonic-Tully-Fisher relation, which was not used in the calibration. So the sizes of galaxies also come out pretty nicely. But what about small scales? So the Eagle simulation works well over five orders of magnitude, but it sort of stops resolving objects much smaller than the Milky Way. And on small scales, there are some issues with the CDM model that I'm sure you're familiar with. So, for example, this shows the stellar to halo mass relation that's required in order to match the observed stellar mass function to the predicted halo mass function in CDM. So it's pretty steep, and it requires low mass halos to be extremely faint, for the galaxies in low mass halos to be extremely faint, while real dwarf galaxies that we can see around the Milky Way aren't as faint. So this shows the stellar to halo mass ratios of real dwarf galaxies around the Milky Way. And if every, well, you can clearly see there's a difference here. Another way of saying this, that if every satellite of the Milky Way had a galaxy like the real ones, there would be vast overabundance of satellites, which we don't see. So this is another way of saying that there's a sort of missing satellite problem around the Milky Way.
But you have to be very careful. Right?
Yes,
that,
so when I...
The line there, that's the average. Basically, yes. You cannot really... there could be a huge
yeah, there, of course.
Something maybe not... Maybe you have dark galaxies.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll come back to the dark galaxies in my talk. That's what my simulation produced. But yeah, so this is naively, if you take a dark matter-only simulation, say this is the average halo mass function, now we take the stellar mass function, this should be the average result, and these are real galaxies that are observed. So naively, if you take a dark matter-only simulation, pure dark matter simulation, you predict an overabundance of low-mass halos, and if you fill them all with galaxies with stellar-to-halo mass ratios like observed, there would be an overabundance of galaxies that aren't seen. But this is one problem. I'm not saying it doesn't have a solution. I'll come to the solution later. Another problem that's been identified is the so-called too-big-to-fail problem. So if we look at, again, dark matter-only simulations of Milky Way mass halos, and we look at the individual satellites and plot their velocity, the circular velocity function, we get for each of these Milky Way halos, we get these curves. And then we can plot the observed circular velocity at the half-light radius for individual satellites. And there are some curves that are well-matched that could potentially host these observed satellites. But this was a paper by Mike Bolin-Colchin, which had six Milky Way halos in Lambda CDM. And each of these contained a number of halos that don't match any of the observed Milky Way satellites. And this is a more severe version of the missing satellite problem, I would say, because these halos are massive. They should survive reionization. So that's why this is called the too big to fail problem. They're too big to be left completely dark by reionization. So this is another issue for a Lambda CDM on small scales. There appears to be in each of these resimulated Milky Way halos a number of large satellites that have no observed counterparts. I should say that the three most massive satellites are taken out of each of these panels, and also the three most massive Milky Way satellites are taken out of these panels. So the statistics isn't as bad as, let's say, 0 to 5, but it's more like 3 to 8. But there's still an overabundance. But of course, the small scales also have an advantage, because now on small scales, the alternatives to the CDM model actually become testable. So this is from a paper by Mark Lovell. This shows one of the Aquarius halos, the same ones where the too big to fail problem was identified, in cold dark matter, and here in warm dark matter. And you can see that, for example, warm dark matter models, while they agree with the CDM predictions on large scales, like in the Millennium simulation, you would see absolutely no difference. But on small scales, you can see that the number of substructures is reduced. So if we take these small scale problems for CDM seriously, we could potentially find out something about the nature of dark matter by looking at these small scales. This is another alternative. So this is a CDM model, but it's coupled to photons in the early universe. This is using one of the halos from my simulation. So this is a CDM version of that halo. This is the photon-coupled CDM version. And again, it reduces the number of substructures. So we can potentially use these Loken group dwarf galaxies to test the nature of dark matter. And I think that's what makes them very interesting. So, well, if we summarize the introduction, CDM is successful on large scales, but appears to fail on the small scales observed in the local group. But so this is somehow a conflicting statement, maybe. But we also know that on large scales, the formation of structures is determined pretty much purely by gravity. And on small scales, baryon effects may become important. And these failures of the CDM problem have all been, or of the CDM model, have all been identified in pure dark matter simulations, ignoring baryonic effects. So we can ask, is this really a failure of CDM, or is it merely a failure of gravity-only simulations to reproduce the formation of structures on small scales? So now we ask, can we extend, by including baryons, the success of the CDM model to the local environment? So that's where the Apostle project comes in, sort of the trying to bring the message of CDM, the gospel, to the local environment. I think that's maybe the motivation for some of the members of the team. But it really stands for a project of simulating the local environment. So what we do is we go to a large N-body simulation. We select 12 local group-like volumes kinematically. So we ask that there should be two halos of around 10 to the 12 solar masses with a certain separation, certain radial and tangential velocity. And we also have some constraints on the local environment. And then we resimulate them at much higher resolution, both as dark matter-only simulations, just like those Aquarius simulations, for example, and also fully hydrodynamically using the Eagle code. So this shows the evolution of one of these simulation volumes. So on the left, you see the gas focus, first of all, on one galaxy. On the right, you see the stars. Now the frame shifts a bit. And so in the end, you see two sort of Milky Way or Andromeda-sized galaxies with lots of satellites flying around. And so this is sort of just briefly the evolution of one of our simulations.
This
is all the gas, just the density of the gas. I mean, this is just an illustration. I think this illustrates the problem a little bit better, or the problem we're trying to solve. So this is from one of our simulations, a local group, and there are really millions of dark matter halos that we can resolve. So we have a particle mass of 10 to the 4 solar masses, and the sky looks nothing like this. So we have, of course, many, many dark matter halos. But if we look at the stars, it looks like this. So there are only a few hundred galaxies. I think the screen doesn't have enough contrast to see hundreds. You maybe see a few dozens here. That may not help, but there are many very faint ones, but there's sort of two Milky Way-like objects with satellites, and then you find a few isolated dwarf galaxies, and if you go back, for example, you can see which halos they live in. So there are only a few hundred galaxies reproduced, so something must happen that leaves all these other halos dark.
So what are the typical mass of the other halos?
I'll come to that. So now we compare this to the real Milky Way, or the real open group, of course. So, well, what happened is that baryons changed the number of luminous and dark halos. So this is stacking several simulations and then looking at how many halos we have in each local group like volume. So we always limit our analysis to about, or not to, about to exactly a radius of 2 megaparsecs from the local group center. So the dashed lines show the halo mass function in the pure dark matter simulation at three different resolution levels. So this is really extremely well converged down to, well, sort of tens of thousands of halos. And the solid black lines, or all the solid lines, are not from the hydrodynamic simulations. The solid lines show the mass function of all the halos, no matter whether they're dark or luminous. So you can see that actually one thing that happens is baryons reduce the abundance of halos. They reduce statistically the mass of every halo because halos lose their baryons. So in a dark matter-only simulation, it is assumed that every halo has its universal baryon fraction or has a cosmic mean baryon fraction, but that's not true in the hydrodynamic simulation. So the mass of all halos is reduced, but that still gives you tens of thousands of halos down to a Vmax of 5 kilometers per second. So what we then do is we look at those halos that are actually luminous, and we run the simulations with and without reionization. So they always include supernova feedback and AGN feedback and gas cooling and all that. But we either include or we don't include reionization. And we couldn't run the highest resolution one without reionization. I will show you in a minute why. It's very expensive. But we already see that without reionization, to some limit, basically all the halos make stars. This doesn't talk about how many stars they make, but they all form stars. But without reionization, and this varies by a factor of 150 in resolution between these, there seems to be a limit where where there's a gap developing between the total halo mass function and the halo mass function of those halos that actually hold galaxies. So below, let's say, 20 to 30 kilometers per second of Vmax, most halos are actually dark.
So, Jeff, yeah. Again, so you say there are stars. How many stars? What's the count? You cannot do
it. So this is just star. This is just a single star. So that also means, for example, yes, this is just a single star forming event. So that means, for example, here in the high res, this is between here and here, it's a potentially a factor of 150 in stellar mass. So even that is resolved. If we asked for there to be always, let's say, a certain limit of stars that we can resolve even this simulation, this conversion would be even better. But this is just halos that form any amount of stars. So in this case, the limit is 10 to the 4 solar mass because it's our particle mass in the highest resolution simulation. Yeah. This just shows, we ask why the number of both luminous and dark subhalos is reduced. One is what I mentioned earlier, that for individual halos that we can match between the hydrodynamic and the dark matter only simulation, baryons cause mass loss, at least in the low mass halos. So Milky Way mass halos, basically, well, we don't have that many here in the Logan group, but this is sort of a running median. Milky Way mass halos obviously experience baryonic processes, but they mostly process the baryons internally. But low mass halos lose baryons or miss baryons, I should say, either by the fact that they don't manage to accrete baryons or by the fact that they eject baryons. This was the two feedback mechanisms that Hojun Mo talked about. And you end up with an average, so there's a big scatter in between the dark matter only and the hydro simulation, also because halos sometimes don't evolve on the same path. But you end up with a mass or Vmax that's even lower as if you just took out the universal baryon fraction at the end. But so this is a reduction in halo mass in the hydro simulation compared to the dark matter only simulation. But more importantly, so that just explains why the total mass function of halos in the hydro simulation is lower. But more importantly is the fact that if you compare the observations, many low mass halos are left dark. So this shows the evolution of gas, again, just gas density, not temperature, in the local group from redshift 10 to redshift 0 with and without reionization. And you can see that by redshift 4 already, there's a lot more structure if there's no reionization included, particularly the low density regions. They're really structured here. They're very smooth when we include reionization. And by redshift 0, there's a lot of fragmentation and a lot of low mass halos are able to cool gas, whereas in the case with reionization included, gas is really only accumulated in the more massive halos. There are some galaxies around here that have been able to cool gas in the past and then ejected it by supernova feedback. But basically, with reionization included, the intergalactic medium, especially in the low-density regions, is much smoother, has much less structure, and there are much fewer galaxies able to form stars. And this is also one reason why these simulations are actually much cheaper to run than these ones, because here you have a lot of objects that you have to resolve. So resimulation, in effect, helps us making the simulations considerably cheaper. So we couldn't run this at the highest resolution. But already at the intermediate resolution, we were far overproducing Logan group galaxies. So you really need reionization. This shows, as a function of mass today, the fractions of halos that are luminous without reionization. Well, there's no convergence. So if we increase the resolution further, we'd get more halos luminous. But with reionization, when we go first, there's sort of, we still produce more galaxies with stars when we increase the particle resolution from about 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 5. But if we increase the resolution further, we still produce almost exactly the same number of halos with stars. So there's a cutoff, basically at 10 to the 10 solar masses today, all halos are luminous. And at 10 to the 8 solar masses today, almost all halos are dark. But in between, it's not a step function. There's a gradient, and the fraction of luminous halos decreases monotonically with halo mass.
Chill.
Yeah.
Are the feedback recipes kept constant at the variable diffusion, or is it
here we keep them constant? Okay. So in the Eagle model, there's a recalibration done between different resolution models. We didn't do that here. We always use the reference model. So the recipes are all kept constant. So this illustrates what happens, here we know that as a function of mass, a fraction of halos are luminous and a fraction of halos are dark. But we really want to understand what makes half of the halos that have few times 10 to the 9 solar masses luminous and what makes them succeed and the others fail. And we can see that when we look at the evolution of individual halos. So first, let's look at the dashed lines, which are all halos that today have a mass of 10 to the 8.5 to 10 to the 9 solar masses, 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 9.5 solar masses, or 10 to the 9.5 to 10 to the 10 solar masses. And this is a little bit of evolution. So we plot the ratio of the mass that the halo had at a given redshift divided by the mass that the halo has today. That's why they're all at 1 here. And there's a little bit of evolution that low mass halos today formed slightly earlier. That's a well-known result of hierarchical formation. But this evolution is very weak. But if we ask now for luminous halos, so we look at those halos where almost all halos are luminous, well, they basically just follow the evolution of all the halos because all the halos are luminous. But then if we go down half an order of magnitude in mass, now about half of the halos are luminous, and we see that those luminous halos form much earlier than the average halos. And if we go down another half order of magnitude in mass where only a few of those halos are luminous, those that are actually luminous have again formed much earlier. So if we look at the time of reionization, those luminous halos actually have fairly similar masses. So there's a factor of 10 in mass here, and there's a factor of 10 in stellar mass here. That's not quite, so since stellar mass isn't proportional to halo mass, that's not quite proportional. But those luminous halos had to have a similar mass at reionization. And of course, for a low mass halo today, that means very rapid evolution early on, and for a high mass halo today, that means not so rapid evolution. And we can even match those individual objects to the dark matter only simulation and find the same result. So a halo has evolved. So if the counterpart in the hydrodynamic simulation is luminous, it has also evolved quicker in the dark matter only simulation. So this is really a feature of the evolution of the halo and not somehow a feedback effect that's only happening in the hydro simulation. And interestingly, if we look at the very faintest galaxies, so this includes both satellites and isolating galaxies, you see that if a halo is less than 10 to the 9 solar mass today, it's typically not at its peak mass today. If it was at its peak mass today, it would have been too low mass typically at reionization. So these are mostly objects that have been stripped and got to their mass today because they were higher mass in the past. And those few, so these are mostly satellites in the Loken group. So you have to basically have a high mass at reionization in order to be luminous. And the mass is high enough so that if you have a very low mass today, you select them here by their mass today at redshift zero. And so if you have the low mass today, you can get there by either growing normally, but then your mass would be too low at reionization, or you get there by growing so you grow early on, and then you lose your mass and come to this mass. And if you select them to be luminous, then those halos that grew normally to a low mass aren't in this luminous sample. So you only select those halos that, when you look at the very low mass halos today and ask that they should be luminous, then you're selecting those that were more massive in the past. I will show that.
But these are all in high density environments.
Well, these are all in the local group, so we didn't break them up by density. But so these are both satellites and isolating galaxies. And interestingly, those few halos that are very low mass today and luminous and isolated, they are typically escaped satellites. So it's rare for a halo to be an escaped satellite, but it's even rarer for a halo to be very low mass and luminous if that's the maximum mass. So this is, I'm here showing all the halos. In the paper, you find them split by satellites and isolated. So one interest, yeah.
It is isolated at the present day.
Yes.
Why don't you, there might be a, they might have running through.
Exactly. So this is what I mean by escape satellites.
Okay.
So those halos, so when in the paper, you can look at the plot. So those luminous halos that are isolated today, that's what I'm saying, or field galaxies in the lowest mass halos are likely to be escape satellites.
Oh.
So that's the fact that they're isolated today doesn't mean that they were always isolated, but if they're extremely low halo mass today and isolated, it's actually quite likely that they're from this small population of escape satellites. And one interesting result of this is, I think this is a nice statistic. So if we look at the formation time of all the halos is very weakly evolving. This is just hierarchical formation. But if we now break up all the halos in luminous and non-luminous, so there's weak formation, or there's weak evolution with mass of the formation redshift overall. But if we break it up into two sort of subsets, there's strong evolution and the same evolution in both the luminous and dark ones. So both luminous halos, let's look at the field halos, show a strong, much stronger evolution than the complete set. And the dark halos, the non-luminous ones, also show a strong evolution. And that might look puzzling. Why do the both subsets show a strong evolution and the total ensemble shows no evolution? But it's basically the fraction of luminous and non-luminous halos changes over mass. So for non-luminous halos, for a non-luminous halo, if you're massive, you have to have formed really late, otherwise you'd be luminous. And for a luminous halo, if you're non-massive, you have to have formed really early, otherwise you'd be dark. So the fraction of luminous and dark halos changes, and so both subsets can show the same evolution, even though the complete set of halos shows almost no evolution. And now I just come briefly to the satellites. So in this mass range, so this is from 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 9 solar mass, halo mass today, where most halos are dark, those low mass halos that host satellite galaxies are very strongly affected by tidal stripping. Because this, again, is a mass range, 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 9 solar masses, which is actually the mass range that we infer for many dwarf spheroidals. You cannot almost get to that mass as your peak mass today and be luminous at the same time. So we compare here for one of the halos. This is the evolution of the size of the halo, basically, the virial radius. And this shows the orbit of all the satellites in this mass range that are inside the halo today. So they're all at a radius. This is radius in kiloparsecs. So they're all inside today. This doesn't include escape satellites. And you can see that the pink curves, the luminous ones, typically came in much earlier than the dark ones. Because if they had this low mass today and luminous, they must have basically been stripped. And so you can look at the evolution of Vmax since infall of these satellites. So this is now for several halos. So the Vmax, which is another way of saying mass at redshift zero, versus the Vmax at infall. Typically, halos lose only about 5% in Vmax from stripping. But luminous satellites lose much more Vmax from stripping if they are in this low mass range. So in CDM, and I think this is an important point, typical satellite galaxies do not live in typical halos. So if you typical satellite halos or subhalos. So if you took a dark matter-only simulation and just populate some of the halos at random with satellite galaxies, you don't pick those halos that actually host the satellite galaxies. Those halos, if they're low mass that host satellite galaxies, have been very strongly affected by stripping. Okay, so this was about the impact of reionization directly on low mass galaxies and how this works. Now we look at some results. So this is again the halo mass stellar mass relation that shows the relation that is required if all halos are on, so if all halos had the same stellar to halo mass ratio, and this is for observed Milky Way and M31 satellites and some dwarf irregulars. This is what the Apostle simulations predict for, or what they produce for centrons and satellites. So it follows with quite a large amount of scatter, just like the observation. It follows the observations much more than this line. So then you would expect that we have a missing satellite problem in the simulation. We have an overabundance of dwarf galaxies. But of course we don't, because we leave so many halos empty. So if we now do abundance matching, this is where this line comes from, not for the total halo population, but only for the halo population that actually made stars, we get this relation. So this, I would say, is a typical required stellar to halo mass ratio in a universe where not all halos are able to form stars. And this is not a fit to our points. So this is abundance matching between an observed stellar mass function and the halo mass function that we get from our simulations if we take out all the dark halos. But it does agree well with the simulation direct results.
Yeah, I see the comparison, you know, again.
If you look at the Worcester result,
yes.
It actually is a matching of
yes.
all galaxies. That's the field
yes.
and everything.
Yes.
There's no condition on the matching between the prediction and observed Wolnarowski function. But in your
yeah.
case, you are conditioned in a log group.
Yes. So
basically, your result apply for this kind of thing that happened at higher ratios. Because your satellite galaxy is actually for the Earth.
No, so we do this, so this shows halo mass today, but we also do this at M peak, and we see the same. So at M peak, of course, we can't know the M peak of these objects, but we also do this abundance matching where for the halo mass function, we don't take the halo mass function today, but we take the halo mass function at peak.
Fine, but then still, you're looking at a galaxy population that formed at a high ratio. And then the relationship
yes.
between stellar mass and halo mass may change with time.
But it doesn't change that much. So it does.
Worcester's model, but if you look at the Lewis model, that changes greatly. And your prediction is exactly what a Lewis model predicts at high degree.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I mean, the Worcester model is it takes the relative zero SCSS stellar mass function and so we take relative zero galaxy. So in the Worcester model, there are, of course, it's a different environment because you need statistics. So you don't do it on the local group, but on a large survey and on a large dark matter simulation. But so it could also be, of course, that the local group is very different from the environment.
We know that because the satellite galaxies, they form stars earlier.
But,
that.
Yeah, but we get this deviation from this relation also for the non-satellite galaxies. So the satellite galaxies, if you take them at their mass today, the halo to stellar mass ratio is shifted due to stripping. But if we take them at the mass at the peak mass, which is basically the mass at infall, or the mass they would have if they were evolving in isolation, we get a similar relation. But maybe
we can talk
about that later. Yeah.
How much of this is due to supernova creeping? How much is
So we can't, of course, we have not run a simulation. Well, we have run a simulation without renization, that's true. I haven't tried to do this without renization. I think this gap is mostly due to renization because this is basically due to the fact that most sub halos at this mass range are completely dark. So we could check what this looks like.
Even the ones that are not forming too many stars, so the people
yes.
cannot.
Yeah, so what I've done before, I haven't done this here, I did simulations where I switched on and off individually supernova feedback and reionization. And actually what happens is for the regulation of star formation in those halos that actually form stars, the effect of the two effects amplify each other. So if you leave out supernova feedback, reionization on those halos that formed stars anyway has very little effect because the gas by the time of reionization is already the cooling times are too low, so it holds onto the gas. But if you have supernova feedback included, the gas gets puffed up and reionization can work much, much more effectively at getting gas out of the halo. So I think the two effects are not really, it's hard to say this much is due to reionization and this much is due to feedback. They sort of have to work together. But at the low mass end, most of this difference is due to the fact that low mass halos are completely dark. And if we hadn't included reionization, they would still form stars, probably very little because supernova feedback would shut them off. But we would populate probably this region much more if we didn't have reionization. So we'd have many low mass halos that would make one or two star particles, so they'd be sitting somewhere down here if we didn't have reionization, but then they wouldn't make more stars because of the very efficient supernova feedback. Yeah.
The Worcester's really result comes down to 10 to the 8 solar mass, and
yes.
all of these are extrapolation.
Yes, I should say this is an extrapolation,
yeah.
But there are now, so one caveat that is not so important here, I think, but some people try to match, so for example, there's a paper by Munshi et al. That tunes the supernova feedback so that they can reproduce this relation all the way down to very low masses. And I think that's dangerous because this relation applies that all these halos have made stars. And as my simulations indicate, also those of Takashi Okamoto, for example, many of these halos fail to form stars. So the Worcester relation, I'm not saying what they did is wrong. They did the right thing, in the regime where all halos make stars, but it's dangerous to extrapolate down to low mass halos and think this should be the relation we should be aiming for with simulations, because this relation is only appropriate in the regime where all halos make stars.
What kind of stuff needs to have these objects?
So we have a variety of star formation histories. I think I don't have plots on this, but there's a paper coming out. So we typically have slightly too extended star formations. So I think if we look at the Logan group observation, I think sometimes it's difficult to. I should really speed up. So I think we have slightly too extended star formation histories compared to observations. They're slightly not quite bursty enough. But I just show. Quickly, this is the halo mass function in 12 Milky Way-like volumes. These are observed stellar mass functions for the local group and for Milky Way and M31. These are our stellar mass functions, again, from 12 volumes for the local group and for the Milky Way and M31. So we do reproduce stellar mass function. There's no missing satellite problem anymore. I think I'll skip. Well, this is sort of our effect on the plot I showed earlier for the too big to fail problem. This is our dark matter only simulations. These are our hydro simulations. So the velocities come down to the observations. We skip this bit. But I really need to come to this one. Very quickly, there's not that many results to show anyway. Logan group with blazars. So we tried to run one of these models with the blazar heating model that's in Phil Chang's paper and also in the Puchwein et al. Paper. So we use a strong blazar heating model where blazar heating is basically effective from redshift 5. And we run one of these simulations without blazars and with blazars. So this is just our high resolution volume. Blazars work very well in voids. We have no gas around the high resolution volume. So this gets heated very well. So this is temperature. You have a lot of hot gas. But this is not physical. This is a void that happens because these regions in the simulations only contain dark matter particles. But we can limit our analysis to the real Logan group. So this is 2 megaparsecs. And there we're free of these boundary effects. But unfortunately, there the results look almost identical. So this looks at stars. There's sort of stochastic differences between volume by volume. But there's very little differences in the star formation. This is already the strong model. This shows the rho t diagram. In red, these are points that are outside our 2 megaparsec region. So including the boundary, we had to make some fix here because these particles were getting too hot. So this is cut off. But basically, you get the inversion of the density temperature relation as you would expect. Also, so the white points are inside the Logan group. So you get that for some particles in the Logan group that would have been cooling here that now get heated. But the star-forming gas in galaxies looks pretty much identical in the blazar and non-blazar model. We can also look at some dwarf galaxies in the Logan group. So this is one that I picked from a slightly underdense region. Again, the total gas density looks identical. They have almost the same stellar mass. What we do see, I'm not sure if that comes out here very well, but this is the temperature map of this low density region. The intergalactic medium is hotter in the blazar run than the no blazar run. That's systematic, even in those regions that are far from the simulation boundary. But that hasn't affected star formation, unfortunately, in these galaxies. So if we conclude, well, if we include a realistic model for galaxy formation, we can reproduce the Logan group simulations even in CDM. This doesn't mean that we can verify the CDM model because there's too many uncertainties, but I think certainly future work needs to take Baryon effects into account. We cannot rely on pure dark matter simulations, including even strong blazar feedback in the Logan group, leaving everything else unchanged. Of course, that's a caveat. Heats the diffuse intergalactic medium, but has little effect on the Logan group galaxy population. But shouldn't finish there, because for the future, I think this is where we should be looking at. So this is from a paper by Jesus Zavala, who is actually, he's no longer here, but he was at the Perimeter Institute for some time. This looks at the velocity function as measured in H1 by the alfalfa survey. So these are the error bars here. And predictions so this is in a larger volume out to about 20 megaparsecs, and prediction for CDM, which is this line, and then prediction for warm dark matter, which is this line. So he claimed in this paper that CDM basically fails to reproduce the abundance of H1 measured galaxies, mostly in voids, whereas warm dark matter could match that. And I think this is the gap we should be trying to close, maybe with blazar heating. So this would be something to look at, not in the Loken group, but in less dense regions, where there seems to be an underabundance of galaxies produced or observed as compared to naive CDM predictions.
Should the same mechanism be touched on for the Loken group work there too?
Yeah, I don't want to spoil this. We did some tests earlier with a gimmick simulation where we said, well, we can sort of reproduce also a downturn here without blazars, but we haven't tested this yet with the real voids. We haven't tested this with a really, so the gimmick model where we did this very quick analysis doesn't reproduce the stellar mass function, for example, so we don't know whether the feedback is actually realistic there. But the plan now is to, sort of starting this year, to do new simulations that include the local voids. So this is what I'm doing in Finland. This is the Sibelius project, simulations beyond the local universe. We'll update the code a little bit. So for example, one thing that we had is reionization redshift 11.5. That's no longer the sort of state of the art. We're moving that to 8.8. That might also mean that reionization is operating slightly weaker, maybe leaving a gap for blazars to play a role. We'll include self-shielding that we hadn't included before. So this is also something that might make the impact of reionization a little bit weaker. And we're hoping also to increase resolution, at least in voids, we can afford that. And so maybe once we've done that, probably at the end of this year, we may still find a smoking gun for blazar heating in the voids. Yeah, thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much. I'm guessing there are still many questions.
Yes, you're showing this velocity function. But then here, how do we know that, because you measure velocity, right?
Yes.
How do we, well, then the H1 gas is only used as a tracer.
Yes.
And then basically if I have dark galaxies,
yeah.
And no matter how low the
yeah.
gas is, then my potential where is there?
Yeah, so you wouldn't measure, so the thing
you
is,
have to have
you
a
have
selection.
To get the H1, exactly, so you have to get the H1 content or the
yeah.
H1 column density below the alfalfa or future SKA detection threshold. So you see this drop of here,
yeah.
clearly this is not because there are fewer low mass halos,
yeah,
because they cannot
be
detected in alfalfa.
Right.
But yeah. up to here, the assumption is that well, every halo that has a Vmax of 35 grams per second or more will be seen in alfalfa.
Okay.
And I think that is something which we showed in the gimmick. Actually, that's not true. Even in 35 grams per second halos, they should contain stars, but the supernova feedback may have heated up the gas so that the H1 column density drops below the selection threshold.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not trying to close this gap by taking out halos. That's what warm dark matter does. But we're trying to maybe close this gap by making some of these halos invisible to alfalfa.
Yes. Yeah.
And so that might be something that maybe blazar heating can also help with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you seem to be very sensitive to the error of when reionization takes place, because basically governed by halos that are luminous are governed by basically when they are.
Yeah, but it's, so I'm trying to get to this plot with the, where you show the evolution. It's not so sensitive. So we've actually done one, so for example, so this shows redshift of, I think this is redshift 9 or 10 here. This is
yeah.
Z plus 1. So if you move reionization a little bit earlier, the halo, so you should look at these gray lines and show the average evolution of halos. So they haven't grown by that much. So I think you may, so if you move reionization from redshift 11.5 to redshift 8.8, you will get somewhat more galaxies, but I don't, so we did a test with 9.5 and we didn't find a big difference.
I see.
But yeah.
So then, okay. So then like in terms of what you mean by reionization, is it like a sudden event for you?
So hydrogen reionization is sudden and it's uniform. So there's a helium reionization later that is spread out over time, but but it's still uniform, so we don't have local sources. Yeah, so that's another question, maybe that. Yes.
Well, I suggest if there are more questions, we take my coffee and we can have a discussion this evening.
Okay.
We can be at 11, I think, and accept.
Okay.
Yeah.